Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's been a marvelous year for writer Jeff Parker, who worked his way through the anthology monster book specials like Where Monsters Dwell and Marvel Adventures featuring the Avengers and the Fantastic Four, to calling the shots for Agents of Atlas, the 50s revival espionage book featuring a group of unlikely heroes reunited to face their greatest menace. We'll also discuss Jeff's other Marvel projects like X-Men First Class, a year one exploration of the group's original five members. Plus, we'll look at Dear John, Doodles from Alex Toth, published by Jeff's company, Octopus Press.
You know, it's weird now that I've listened to you so much more than before when we had just talked. My brain keeps getting in a weird setting like, oh, John's talking to me. I'm not just listening to him. You know, I feel like I'm listening to a show. They're like, oh, wait, he's waiting for me to say something.
Oh, no. Yeah, now it's all about you, Jeff.
That's strange.
No, this is good. No, and I thank you for that a year ago when we talked about the Inner Man and some of your other things that were going on, because it got the ball rolling and it was fun.
Yeah, you really jumped in the element. It's great.
Well, and I'm glad to see that your star is ascending. I think you're doing a great job at Marvel, and they're giving you a lot of fun things to work on. And they got your feet wet, it seems, with Marvel Adventures.
Uh-huh.
And I know you're continuing to work with them. Are you still doing the Avengers for Marvel Adventures?
Oh, yeah. I've got a lot more of those coming up. There's one coming up that's just going to be so great. I really think a lot of people are going to order it, even though they don't even follow the books, once they see Cameron Stewart's cover for it. It has to do with MODOK, but I can't ruin it. Hopefully they'll leak it, because I want people to find out about it.
It's cool, and I like the format of Marvel Adventures in that they're all, you know, self-contained stories, and it's a neat team as well.
Yeah.
It's fun to have the Hulk back on the Avengers.
Yeah, I love the Hulk on the Avengers. Sure, he's hard to control, but, you know, it's the Hulk.
And it's good comic relief, I think, in that all-ages format.
Yeah, and I still haven't got to explore it too much, but I wanted to establish that, it's, you know, just the Hulk doesn't always do what you want him to do, and starts going running off, kind of maybe probably screwing up the plan or whatever, and hopefully I'll be able to get into a better example of that in future issues.
Have you had to retool any stories? I know you started with the Fantastic Four, but, like, you know, pull back in terms of any violence or action because it is an all-ages book?
They always catch me when I sometimes will screw up and have a realistic weapon in.
Okay.
And you can't have, like, something that's like a real working gun.
Okay.
In these books. And what that has to do with is the outlets that they're sold into, you know, I won't name names, but, you know, there are some places that, in fact, do sell guns and ammunition, but they don't want their comics to have that in it, so whatever, yeah, make that of what you will, and that's the kind of thing we have to, other than that, the only real mandate with the books is that they specifically stay away from continuity, because they don't want to ostracize people. They don't want new readers to feel like, oh, I can't jump in on this. And in fact, we don't even, you know, really honor our own continuity. We don't make too much of a connection between the issues, even though I'll once in a while have a little recurring theme. But for the most part, they want everything to stand alone like a little island, and that's the way we do it.
Has the roster changed at all on the Avengers?
No, it's still, gosh, I would be happy to whittle it down a little bit, actually.
It is a big team.
It's a big team, and it's murder on the guys to draw. You know.
Run down the team real fast. It's
Captain America, Iron Man, Spider-Man, Wolverine, Storm, Giant Girl, and the Hulk.
Giant Girl, I like that, yeah.
Yeah, that was because originally when they suggested the lineup to me, they had Giant Man in there, and he kept, I guess they felt like, that makes it look like the Avengers, you know, Giant Man's
sure.
In there. And they were saying, well, you can pick people, but, you know, we need to stick with popular characters that people who don't read the comic books might know. So obviously I thought, okay, well, Storm, they got to know Storm.
Right.
Because now the X-Men movies, just everybody's watched them from birth. And then I was like, okay, it's like, can I change Giant Man to Giant Girl, because I really want another girl on the team. And they actually did that. I think in the 90s they had Wasp. Growing giant sometimes, and I thought it was cool, and I mean, who's going to argue? Ultimately, a giant woman is infinitely more interesting than a giant man.
As proven by Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
Exactly, and you know, there's a subset of fetishists who will will always follow any book with a giant woman in it. So I'm sure we've got them by now.
Who's your artist for Marvel Adventures?
It has been alternating between Manuel Garcia and Juan Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And it's kind of interesting because Juan Santa Cruz, and this is lucky, he kind of specializes on environments and extremely weird, trippy imagery.
Okay.
Which is good because in this one arc from issues 9 through, I got to count, 9, 10, 11, 12. In 9, 10, 11, 12, we have a lot of kind of bizarre stories pop up. And luckily he's on that arc because that's what he does so well. He drew a backup that we did in New Avengers where they asked us to do a Kickers Inc. story. So I sent the Kickers Inc. to hell, which is pretty much where everybody wanted them anyway.
That's a fan wish fulfillment,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and, then I realized what that guy was born for, because he was just going nuts drawing these demons and stuff. I mean, it's like, okay, I see what he wants to draw. And I will try to push things towards what people want to draw.
You did a bunch of monster books last fall, in fact.
Oh, yeah, those were fun.
Is there going to be another crop of those at all for this Halloween season?
I don't know. I haven't asked that. Well, I'm going to assume not, because I haven't heard of them by now, and we'd already be writing them right now, I assume.
Sure.
Unless, of course, I wasn't invited. It's probably one of those things with those events. They don't want to wear it out. They're going to probably break it out every couple of years or so. But that sure was fun.
No, and it definitely did
hearken. It was fun doing that in Westerns, you know.
But... Yes, and I wanted to know about that as well, because it is nice. It seems, Jeff, that you're getting a lot of those assignments that they're not tied to Civil War or the big continuity. And there's like this corner of Marvel that is kind of spitballing a lot of other characters and a lot of other concepts just to see what kind of interest there might be. Although it also seems like they don't get a ton of pub. I mean, it seems like the Westerns and the Where Monsters Dwell section did in terms of when they were released. But, yeah, you tell me. I mean, how's that been?
Make no mistake. We're all the focus is still on Civil War. But yet, you know, they're kind of graciously allowing, okay, here's a little bit of space over here, do some other things. And for some reason, you know, I tend to fall into that one a lot. I've found someone mentioning online, it's like, Jeff Parker gets to flourish under benign negligence or something. And it's kind of a good quote, because that's exactly what's happening. It's like you're not paying attention to him, so he can kind of do all these weird stories that he wants to do. And it's you know, it's a lot of fun. It's one of the things as maybe as readership grows that the market for the alternative genres will naturally appear again. I sure hope so.
Yeah.
You know, I love writing superheroes, but I don't think that should be everything that's on the stands by a long shot. But yet, you know, all of Marvel is built on selling superheroes for 40 years. So asking them to suddenly, you know, become a horror publisher, it's not something their machine is geared for. So, you know, we're just trying to poke around, get the stories, and draw audiences and do something a little different. And that's kind of what Agents of Atlas is. You know, it's like our chance to maybe tell some different types of stories than you normally would. And there's probably never going to be, again, that big an audience for Westerns, unfortunately, but I don't know. Maybe we can find some way for him to exist, because everybody who worked on those was just having a blast.
Yeah, you know, I talked to even Jim McCann, who even got to do a quick 10-pager about
yeah,
that.
They're even breaking out Jim McCann.
Exactly. But it was really fun, and it was this kind of Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn little
that was fun.
Interlude. Yeah, and what was your Western story that you did?
Mine was The Man Called Hurricane.
There you go.
It was an update of this story about this weird guy who's fighting was he fighting Ghost Rider? Who is bouncing around at super speed out in the desert doing cartwheels and shooting his guns like crazy. And I think Mark Panicia, when he assigned that to me, thought I was going to come up with something extremely wacky to kind of go with that. But for some reason, I and Carl Kiesel and Fred Van Lente, everybody kind of went dark with their stories. And I guess you can't argue with it. That's just the way people see it. That's the way they see it.
Sure.
And Tom Coker was the artist on it, and Tom just does such great realistic and moody stuff, you know, so we kind of cooked up a way that could, you know, this super speed, I limited it to him being a quick draw. He can't run around really fast or anything or hop on a cosmic treadmill and go back in time, but, and it only kicks in like when he is actually in danger and drawn upon. So suddenly he's completely useless, no different than anyone else, until someone points a gun at him. And then suddenly, like, he's going nuts with the guns, and the Indian girl, Little Cloud, who comes along with him, is just throwing loaded guns at him in bandoliers so he can fire, because he's got this enormous 100-man posse that's after him. And my God, it's like, you know, it was kind of like just doing the modern version of what they were doing then, which is they were trying to kind of keep their feet in superheroes yet still do Westerns.
Uh-huh.
You know, they were being pretty experimental back then. It didn't always work, but, you know, some kind of weird energy you've got to admire.
Oh, yeah, and I think you're right. I think especially like Two Gun Kid and the original Ghost Rider, no, those were kind of interesting ideas. So was Hurricane a new concept, or were you rebooting an old concept with Hurricane?
He was a bad guy.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think he only appeared in one or two stories. I don't think he was around very much, and I think he fell off a cliff or something. That's the way everybody dies in the
sure.
U.S. You know, cliff.
Well, let's dive into Agents of Atlas, because I loved that original What If story. It was either number 8 or number 9.
9.
Okay. And did Roy Thomas write that story, or did someone else write that story?
I believe the way that worked was Roy Thomas was the editor and assigned Don Glut, who had done Trag and the Sky Gods and some other stuff at the time. And clearly the whole premise feels Roy Thomas-y.
Yes.
You know, it's very JSA at the time, so which is all him at the time.
You're right, in terms of like taking single characters from the 50s and kind of cobbling a team when there really was never a team back when they were originally running in
the
50s.
It was a retcon, and they were all, you know, and I think Don helped him pick out a few from what I've read. Like, I think he thought he found the human robot and said, okay, this will be... And obviously what they were trying to do was do a corresponding team to the Avengers, because the whole thing was called the 50s Avengers.
Yeah, what if the Avengers had formed in the 1950s?
So they're correlating. Venus is the, you know, the stand-in for Thor there. And
right.
Gorilla Man, of course, the Beast, because the Beast was on the Avengers at the time.
Sure. Human robot for the Vision.
Then the one everyone argues with me is of course, 3D Man.
Yes.
Everybody's like, 3D Man was on the team. I'm like, yeah, but he wasn't an Atlas character. It's like, to me, I thought it was just going too far. If I were going to bring this into the 616 universe. And the problem is, I mean, I know it's a retcon, obviously. Don't make me define that, because I'll lose my mind.
Oh, no, no. Well, I think listeners know what retcon is, or continuity implant. Yeah, I understand.
You probably have this somewhere listed on the Word Balloon site. Hit this for retcon. But anyway, I thought the reason he was obviously brought in was because they needed somebody like Captain America, I think.
Sure.
But then they brought into the story. I got the sense reading the story that they wanted to use Namora, but since she didn't kind of fit the lineup, you know, they just sort of have her pop in for a minute, help them find the human robot, and then she swims away. And the whole time I'd read that, I thought, think how awesome this would be if Namora were in the story.
Absolutely. Like,
and because in my mind, I was looking at it like, well, when you take 3D Man out, whatever he is, Christmas colored guy. Who does everything, you know, eats three times as many Twizzlers as anybody else.
Three times the speed, three times the strength of a top human being.
Yeah, it's a little weird to quantify. and it's the kind of thing that I remember in those Marvel premieres when he would be in the story. You know, he's constantly having to think of what it is he does. Like, he has to remind himself or he can't do it. I'm not saying we won't ever revisit the concept of 3D Man. It'll probably be a little bit revisionist. It'll probably be pretty different than three times this and that.
Well, and I lost track of him. Did he become Triathlon or whatever?
Yes, I think. Was it Busick who did that?
Maybe. Yeah, I have to admit, and I know that was like a classic Avengers run. I really wasn't reading it back then.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. He from that point, convolutes quite a bit.
Yeah.
If I can use the word that way. And I felt like, okay, if we're going to iron out anyone's continuity to bring them back, and both are going to, and they're going to be pretty involved, we're going to go with Marvel Boy because, you know, he really did exist back then. He had his own comic book, and you know, he's kind of a legacy character. He leads to other characters like Quasar.
You bet.
So I felt like Marvel Boy just deserved it a little bit more than you know, the guy who had appeared in Premiere for three issues.
And he almost, in this miniseries so far, it reminds me of Dave Bowman in 2001 and 2010.
That's a good catch. That actually is a very good point, because he's the spaceman who's been gone a long time. You can hear the David Bowie playing in the background, too.
Major Tom, yes.
he essentially is Major Tom, and I think I had that somewhere in the notes to Leonard at the beginning.
That's great.
In the next one, in issue three, you get the full lowdown on him and find out what's been going on. But, he's much more like a gray alien now, because most of his powers do focus on his mental abilities, and he doesn't fly around and blast little lasers out of his wrist anymore. But the main thing for me was that once you put Nomura back in the lineup, then all the characters you had were archetypes of Pulp Fiction. You had a gorilla.
Yes.
Or Beastman, rather, and you had a robot, you had a spaceman, you had a goddess or mythical creature, and you had a mermaid. And I was like, it all works, and Jimmy Woo's a secret agent.
Yep.
It's like, man, then you get, I suddenly had mythic appeal to me. And it's funny because I was reading the reviews, and so many people go, I just can't believe, so I thought these were a bunch of D-list characters or whatever, and suddenly, I was really into the story, and I think that's what it is. You get the dynamic just right, and then they kind of work themselves.
Well, I give credit to Thomas and Glut, first figuring that out back in What If 9, and then Busick bringing him back in Avengers Forever, and now you're taking him in a new spin, and it's great to see what new directions you're putting him in, especially Jimmy Woo, who, from that What If 9, I always would look forward to seeing him occasionally when he'd pop up in S.H.I.E.L.D. stories. And it was such an interesting character when I started reading back about him, too, because he was the counterweight to the Yellow Claw.
Yeah.
Which on its surface sounds like such a bad, stereotypical story that I guess Al Feldstein did for Atlas back in the day.
Yeah, thanks to Feldstein, what you end up getting is a Chinese-American hero way before anybody else did one.
You bet.
And I was like, and I remember having to go back and look that way. Wait, did they actually have Jimmy Woo? It's like, man, that's great.
Yep.
It's like, no one was doing that. And, of course, it would be Feldstein, who, is getting all kinds of forward-thinking stuff in EC Comics as well. And in fact, when you go back and read the Yellow Claw stuff, he's not really that campy. The name, I think, they borrow from just a Fu Manchu story, obviously, because that's what he is. He's a Fu Manchu knockoff originally, but instead of Nyland Smith, they make it Jimmy Woo, and then the whole book has this whole kind of Chinese vibe to it, which is really neat. It's like, I wish it had continued that way. Kirby took over the very second issue, and from what I can tell, he was pretty much just using old Doc Savage stories.
Okay.
I mean, they're still great, but it's like it didn't keep going in the direction that first one was going in. But once again, you go through and Fu Manchu, Yellow Claw just wasn't really as cartoony as you expect him to be, and you just go, God, if they had just dumped that damn name, it's like, just don't call him Yellow Claw, but they did.
Yeah.
And then of course, one of the first things I asked myself when bringing all this back up is, okay, would he have really called himself Yellow Claw? Jimmy never says what his real name is. What is his real name? And start going into the character, and then I start kind of examining the history between the two. And then it occurs to me, it's like, okay, we can set up something where there's a lot more between the lines than we were getting before. And, and maybe the whole cartoony Yellow Peril Menace thing is actually a bit of a front.
By design, yeah.
Yeah. So, you won't really get the full news on that until issue six, but you'll find out.
Very cool. I always, in fact, when I talk to Paul Galassi and other guys, whenever I talk about Shang-Chi, and I know that obviously one of the things that's keeping Marvel from ever re-releasing any of those great runs of Shang-Chi from the 70s is Fu Manchu. And it always seems like it's the easiest continuity fix where, can't you just call him the Yellow Claw instead?
Make him Yellow Claw.
Exactly. And it would be interesting to see Shang-Chi and Jimmy Woo kind of intersect in that way.
Or make him the Mandarin, whatever. Yeah.
Sure. And I even noticed Reggie Hundlin even, said, I had many names. I noticed when he had Shang-Chi pop up in Black Panther, he had Fu Manchu show up and say, well, I've gone by many different names. And he gave him the name Han, which was the bad guy's name in Enter the Dragon, which I thought was kind of neat. You've resurrected Jimmy Woo, but he is the naive 1958 Jimmy Woo in the 21st century.
He's pretty much like like if you ever worked in Photoshop and you had to go back to a previous state, and that's essentially what's happened. You know, this is, well, here you are at a saved state. Sorry, I don't know what came of you later. that's what we've got. So Jimmy's still talking 50 slang and, you know, and constantly surprised by traffic and things like that. You know.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what his girlfriend from the 50s looks like now in the modern age.
We don't deal with that in this miniseries.
Oh, okay.
Though we will allude to it a little bit. And hopefully, you know, if it goes through and gets to another miniseries, you know, then you that's probably really what we're going to do is bring Su-Wan back into it.
Okay. And it's great to see Gorilla Man, and I think you give him a little depth, and I hate to use the word, but I can't think of another one, gravitas, because he's the one that's kind of endured these decades since the 50s, granted, you know, in the jungle, but he kind of is the one that's the wise one of the group now that really knows what's going on.
Yeah, everybody has to defer to him, which is funny. You know, it's like, let's see what Ken thinks about this. And it's like, yeah, okay, everybody has to wait for the gorilla to explain it.
Exactly.
Because they're just all, everybody's been gone except for him.
Well, I think you tied in the What If Night story really well in the first issue.
Yeah, we kept a lot of the original mission. The whole thing is where Eisenhower's been kidnapped and stuff. And obviously at the end we're going to shed a little more light on that. But, you know, I thought, well, it's like, well, we don't have to throw that out. You know, we can totally just really indulge in the pulpiness right here at this point.
Well, I know too from our previous conversations, you're a huge Spy fan, and obviously it's stemming from even your own creator owned projects like The Interman.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed a lot of your ideas that you've done online to kind of get a campaign for some support.
Uh-huh.
And the whole Temple of Atlas thing has been a lot of fun to read on the Marvel blogs, and you know, it's been an interesting supplemental story. And I even saw online too that people were asking that you know, with the eventual trade, if that tech story that people can find online will be collected eventually.
We've talked about it. I think it's one of those decisions where whoever crunches numbers tells us how many pages we have to fill with whatever. And if, you know, and often things are like that, are okay, as long as new art or something expensive like that doesn't have to be created.
Uh-huh.
So there probably at least there's going to be another 1958 mission online, and but probably at least that first one will get in there, I hope.
Very cool. And you know, and that's kind of a throwback too to the 40s and 50s when they would put a tech story in, I think, to qualify as a magazine and get a special postage rate.
Yes, that is exactly what it was.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
And that was
it goes two pages there, now it's a magazine.
Exactly. And it's that kind of move that afforded Stan Lee his first writing jobs at Timely back in the day.
Oh yeah, little Stan was writing those things.
Text pieces for Captain America.
Yeah, and for me it's a lot of fun because I get to practice a little prose, but since I've got under the conceit that it's a pulp story, I don't have to stress over, you know, like how I'm depicting it, because you know, if you've ever really read some Doc Savage or some of the Shadow stuff, they weren't so super sophisticated. You know, you're not.
Oh no.
You're not reading Faulkner there. So there's neat stuff, but you know, they're going a mile a minute because they're getting paid by the word, and you know, so kind of operates under that conceit. And then of course, you know, that gives me some freedom, so that if I accidentally write something good, it's like, oh well, I could hardly help myself. naturally, I wanted to write something good. I was having such a blast with that, especially at the. I don't want to ruin it for people who now are just finding out about it and will go online. You can read through them all, and, you know, all the people who participated have already solved all the puzzles, so you can, you know, the whole backwards blog thing doesn't confuse you. You can go back and read them all in order. And but then you get to a big finale in Washington, D.C. with a monster, and that stuff was especially fun to write.
Very cool.
And then at the end, I was sitting there just thinking of all the stuff that I, oh, there's some other good 50s things I could have had them do. And I went, okay, I'll just go ahead and do another story.
There you go. Very cool. And thank you for the cameo in the story. I got
I thought you, yeah, you made an excellent engineer.
Yeah, I was like Scotty.
Yeah.
That's what I thought
you
of.
You were Scotty. You're there at the Marshall Air Center working on a trying to get the Mercury 7 up into space.
Which is awesome because I love all that early NASA stuff. I think that's great.
And that's why, and of course, Gorilla Man's all into them. And there's a little kind of a little looping going on there because when I gave notes to Leonard, you get to see in issue 3, you get to see what Gorilla Man would look like if he were human.
Okay.
Marvel Boy projects when they go walking down with his headband, when they go walking through the streets of San Francisco, so that people aren't paying attention to them, you know, they just see a bunch of ordinary people. And you get to see what, and essentially the way I see him is he's Fred Ward.
Okay.
And because now we've established, because, you know, you have to have a reason why he's good with all the military equipment, other than just, you know, just because you're a gorilla doesn't necessarily make you, you know, the world's best machine gun man or whatever.
No, opposable thumbs and all.
So here we beefed up his origin a little bit, that he was a soldier of fortune before he got the curse. And then that's me making the connection to who should have played Captain Easy, which should have been Fred Ward back in the 80s if they had done a Captain Easy movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and for people who don't remember, Fred Ward was Remo Williams in the
exactly
in the movie that HBO shows a million times a year.
And he's Gus Grissom in The Right Stuff.
You bet he is. And he's a fine Gus Grissom. No, he's a very good character actor.
Yeah, he's the most believable astronaut, I think, of the bunch.
I think you're right.
And for some reason, he just seems like somebody who'd be a test pilot. And that's why in the little part of the online story when they're talking about Marvel Boy mentions, like, these guys would launch themselves up on a trebuchet if they could. And he goes, yeah, that's my kind of guy. Of course he likes him. He's one of them.
That's cool. Would you ever want to write Remo Williams style or Mac Bolan executioner style kind of men's adventure stories like that?
Maybe something a little more involved. But, yeah, that's good stuff. I mean, it's a lot of fun. And I was realizing writing these that, oh boy, I can really go into some stuff I just don't have room in the comic books to do.
Sure.
That's the thing. Is storytelling in any form is really fun to me. If I thought I could pull off a good puppet theater, I'd do it that way. But I just don't think I'd be very good at it. But yeah, I mean, I do plan to dabble a little more into that scary world of words without pictures, but, you know, not too much.
All right, let's talk about X-Men. Or actually, before I get off of Agents of Atlas, we briefly mentioned Leonard Kirk, great artist.
Oh, he's terrific.
And you know, if people remember, he had such a great run on JSA, mm-hmm. and he's doing a great job for you now as well.
Yeah,
so,
wait till you see this upcoming stuff. The one I can't wait for people to see, I think people are really going to like number 3, but I can't wait for people to see number 4 when they really start going after the Atlas Foundation. Because you get to see all of these fronts of the organization, and we essentially just switch genres every page, and Leonard knocks every single one of them out of the park. I don't think people realize how versatile he is, but they will after this.
That's really cool. Has he been doing the covers too?
We'll never be able to get him back when we try to do it.
Has he been doing the covers too?
No, Tom Coker's doing the covers.
The covers look great, and I think. For people who didn't know who these characters were, I have a feeling that you got a lot of people picking them up on the newsstand and saying, "Ooh, that looks interesting. What the hell's that?"
Yeah, and I saw online a lot of people mentioned that they're in the shop. They didn't even know what the book was, you know, and they just saw, well, that looks interesting, and they grabbed it. And it's like people say that doesn't work anymore, but it does. You know, covers really can make you grab something.
You bet.
If they're striking enough. And Tom's been trying to approach them all like movie posters. You know, every cover is specific to one of the 6 characters. So, you know, he's just, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like, it doesn't look like anything else on the stands, I don't think. And it all automatically sets the tone from the beginning, which is what a good cover does. You know, you think, oh, well, wait a second, there may actually, this seems to have some substance to it. And so you go into it thinking, being prepared a little bit for something different than you usually get.
Let's talk about X-Men First Class.
Yeah.
That starts this week. And, you know, for me, I am not a new X-Men fan, and when I say new X-Men, I even go back to that, you know, second group that included Wolverine and all those guys. For me, it always...
Yeah, it's like they're still pretty new. I'm not sure who those guys are. Wolva, huh? What is it?
But the original five is what I grew up on, I think, because my first exposure to them was in one of those origins of Marvel Comics or Son of Origins, wherever they first appeared.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see the original five.
May have even been in Collector's Item. You remember that they had one called Collector's Item?
I remember.
Of course, nothing called a Collector's Item has ever been a Collector's Item, but that was the actual title of it. And it would just reprint. They may not have been in that one, but they were reprinted.
Oh, my God, a million times. I mean, you know, and I know Marvel Superheroes, and, you know, I mean, it was just, they were kind of the bastard stepchildren team because they, for whatever reasons, obviously they didn't click, and it took that new group to kind of get people excited about the X-Men finally. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see the original five. I know they came back in X-Force, and there have been other times when we've seen them in modern day, but it's nice to see them back in those first years when the team was a brand new idea.
Yeah. Well, and they're fun to write, too. They're good characters. And I think, you know, a few of them have been marginalized over the years. And, of course, Jean Grey's just not around.
Right.
Unless she is, and I just don't know it. But
is Warren still blue?
No.
Okay.
And in X-Men continuity right now, I'm pretty sure he looks like just he's not Archangel anymore.
Okay.
that was a nice try on the Simonsons' part.
Absolutely.
They were trying to just revitalize the character and make people like him or whatever, but I never quite went for the wing shooting blade feathers or whatever it was. I mean, you know, it's just, I think a lot of times, and this happens with all the superhero books, they all just kind of will go down the path like the James Bond movies did for a while, where it's like, oh, we've just got to have something bigger. So ultimately, what you get is Moonraker. not a very good movie. And, you
know, no, it's like, not.
Well, there's Bond in space, and there's Jaws, and they're in space, and it's kind of gotten pretty far away from, you know, the stuff that I think's best about it, or whatever. Characters just don't have to be super all powerful, I think, to be interesting. I know the rationale is a big deal. Angel can fly. Everybody can fly. But then you just have to go deeper into his character and find some things about him that makes him appealing to read.
Well,
Spider-Man's not the most powerful character in the Marvel Universe, but he's still the most popular.
No, and I thought they did a good job in that original run of the soap opera of that original five X-Men team.
Yeah.
In terms of the conflicts within the team and you know, the Warren and Scott vying for Jean and Bobby being the kid, and of course, always good to see Hank without the blue fur for a while, and remember what Hank looked like. And I know even Whedon for a while kind of toyed with, you know, the prospect of him going back to that look in his first Astonishing X-Men arc. So it's nice to see Hank McCoy back when he was just the big guy with giant feet and just a big muscle guy.
Well, it's funny, and that kind of, to me, that goes back to Kirby. They always seem to go back to Doc Savage for source material.
Yep.
Because there's no way the Beast isn't just Monk.
Monk Mayfair, yep.
He's Monk. I mean, that's exactly the way he's described in the books. You know, this brilliant guy with big feet and hands bouncing around. And it seems like, we'll try to balance this brain and brawn thing together in him or whatever. And then of course, he kind of gets co-opted by, of course, Wolverine, who's essentially the same character but with claws.
That's true.
Well, not as smart. We can assume Wolverine's not as smart, but he doesn't have to be. He's in every comic book now.
Well, and even Hank's brilliance, I think, came much later. Was it always part of the original?
No, he was always very smart.
Was he? Okay.
Stan always showed that by having him, you know, breaking out the thesaurus. He's always, you know, saying all the big words. And, like, for the purposes of these stories, I'm trying to go into a little more of the dynamics they would have had together. Like, I figured Hank's really the teacher's pet, you know, because he's dying to get more Professor X time because it's somebody who he can talk to on his level.
Right, who challenges him, okay.
You know, it's like, oh boy, I can talk to somebody who understands me because the rest of the team's not quite into the movies and books I suggest to them all the time. You know, and it's kind of fun to look at him from that angle. But of course, since, you know, while fighting, I don't ever trust the action to stop for more than a couple of pages. Like that, they could always be fighting while this is going on.
I also liked, I read the first few preview pages, And I thought it was neat that Bobby Drake was writing a letter home about his experiences, you know, in the school.
Because Professor X won't let him use email.
And again, a kind of continuity implant, sort of in the same way that Joe Casey was doing with Earth's Mightiest Heroes, where it's a year one adventure, but it's a year one adventure that's, you know, obviously everything needs to be adjusted so that, you know, the X-Men are only so many years old.
Yeah, the Marvel keeps it sliding around 10 to 13 years, as I understand it. So no matter what's going on, it's only that far back, or
okay.
Otherwise, you know, there's Reed and Ben fighting the Korean War again.
Sure, even World War II.
World War II.
You know, they apparently, you know, were meeting Nick Fury back in World War II and everything with the Howlers. So
that's true. Yeah, it's like Dun Dugan again. Back when you know, standard military gear was just a derby or. The Marines didn't expect you to really stick to a uniform, apparently.
Well, and the only Howler that makes sense now is Percy, because now Percy could be part of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Exactly.
You know?
again, a Doc Savage list. It is. It always goes back to Doc.
Oh, was yeah, I guess so. He was, who was indubitably? See, this is good. This is just for you and me, because nobody listening like gives a damn about the five other than you and I right now. See?
Oh.
Well, that's Cadney Nast's problem. They have these great characters, and they don't bring it back enough. Maybe it was Remy.
Remy, that's it.
There you go.
And, it's like that. Don't mess with things that work, you know. Go right back to them.
That's funny.
They're ripping them off. They're just doing the time-honored tradition of trying to find archetypes and
sure.
And work off of them.
You know? Absolutely. Did you ever read any of those Marvel Doc Savage comic stories, even the Black and Whites?
Of course, yeah.
That was good stuff.
And, probably the thing is, like you said, the X-Men sort of bounced around being sort of bi-monthly or whatever in the 60s, and they didn't really catch on until Claremont came out with, you know, the second team.
Yeah.
But I'm sure a big part of them not wanting to let go of it is, look, we figured out a way. We don't have to keep thinking up these secret origins all the time, you know. It's like, they're just mutants there. It's like, and that is fairly brilliant. It's like, they're mutants there. We don't have to come up with anything. Even at the beginning, they still would kind of explain that, you know, everybody's working around Los Alamos or something like that. But then later, that just got dropped altogether, and it's just they're mutants because they're mutants. And by God, they found a way to make it work.
Well, yeah, for me, there's always been too many mutants as the cast grew. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm glad to see there's another project where it's like, no, let's go back to the beginning when there was five.
And again, I'm glad that Marvel seems to be getting serious about more things like done in one stories now.
That's what was going to be my next question. Go ahead.
Because I think that does help kind of steer you away from it's just bad to feed on your own continuity too much. You just create this kind of incestuous thing that's just too hard for new readers to get into. And it doesn't matter how many little boxes at the top of the book you put explaining who they are. It's like, you know, if it just looks too long and convoluted, people aren't going to pick it up. Unless that's why they're into it, you know.
Now how many issues is First Class going to be?
It's going to be 8 issues.
Okay, and self-contained stories, but connecting.
Yeah, they're all individuals. And if for some reason, you know, someone did mention the idea, it's like, well, you know, it's like people seem pretty interested in it. You know, we could possibly have it go on. So I immediately said, okay, can I do longer than one issue stories if we do that? Because, you know, it's fitting stories in between very established stuff isn't that easy.
Sure.
You know, you got to constantly find ways to not upset the Tinker Toys that the whole thing's built on, and even now I'm still got to hope readers are a little patient and not, you know, just being too sticklers with it. Like, they did not meet Doctor Strange at this point, you know. Thor did not show up in their world until this. You know, it's like, come on, you know, we got to, in the service of entertainment, let's say.
Yeah, unclench your asses, people.
But
that's
anyway, so if somehow it did continue on past that, probably the stories would at least go to two-parters.
Okay.
Because I'd like a little breathing room.
Very cool.
Like, come on now. I've had to, like, in just like 1 year, I've written like 50 stories or something, and because all of mine have to be.
Yeah, really, man. That's a good point. Everyone else could kind of kick back and write, you know,
right,
two stories
a
year.
A year-long story? Let's slowly step into this. whatever. And now when I get like two issues of something, I just say, oh, I've got so much room. What will I do with all of it?
And the art team looks great. Man, that first cover is gorgeous. It really is.
Yeah, Marco Dujevic, he's a German artist who lived here in the States for a little bit. He just now moved back to Germany like a few weeks ago.
No kidding.
Yeah, he was living down in San Francisco, and I'm so glad they got him because, like, I guarantee a lot of the interest in it was simply off of his covers alone.
No question. I mean, that's a gorgeous painted cover. And who's your interior guy?
It is Roger Cruz.
Very cool.
Yeah, and who's kind of reinvented himself for this. You know, he's always sort of a chameleon anyway, but now he seems to have settled into a new style that I think he really wants to stick with, and it's neat. It just looks very European influenced. They're, you know, they're one of those no shadows anywhere. So then when there is a shadowy scene, we have to do it with color or whatever. But it's really cool. He's clearly having a blast. His girlfriend, he's Brazilian, so his girlfriend translates it for him or whatever, and they were writing me back going, thanks for putting all this humor in here. I went, yeah, well, that's kind of the way I'm going to do anything. Even when it's heavy, I think there's room for humor. In fact, I think it works better that way usually. They
sure.
play off each other really well. I don't like things that go either too ha-ha or too dark. You know, I feel like that you can get the most out of both by weaving them together.
Are you the guy when it comes to Octopus Press? How does that work exactly?
Oh, yeah, it's just me.
Okay. You released a book, you know, this year. Unfortunately, it became a very timely book with the passing of Alex Toth.
Yeah.
Letters to John.
Yeah.
And I've been looking at Alex Toth's letters that he's written to Roy Thomas's alter ego for the last few years.
Oh, yeah.
And they are fascinating because they're always very interesting in terms of what he writes about in his reminiscings.
Well,
but
his memory is incredible.
Yeah.
And you then, know, you just look at it and go, God, how can that guy remember detail? And it's like, well, okay, look at the way he draws. You know, he'll put salient I'm saying this in the present tense for some reason, but he'd put salient detail into stuff. And it's like, okay, it's the exact detail you needed at that point. It says it all. And it's because he has a memory for such stuff or whatever. So, yeah, reading those letters is generally pretty fascinating stuff.
And he worked for everybody. I mean, he started in the Eisner studio.
Yeah.
And you know, continued to work for everybody and touched so many interesting characters. And then, plus the letters themselves are always fascinating because he would, you know, basically write postcards, but they'd maybe even be on envelopes sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And just these great little doodles that he would put to illustrate his you know, letters to people.
What I can't figure out is how, and I guess it's something that goes with just lettering in comics, how you, over the years, get a sense of how many, without having to count them out, how many characters you have space for when you're writing word balloons. And he seemed to do the same thing with postcards. It's like, how did he not run out of room? He got it right to the point. It's like it ended right there without him having to continue anywhere. It's like he knew exactly how much you say on a postcard, and I probably just drove the postman nuts because, you know, he would use every tiny iota space except for the part where he, with your address on it. You know, there's just this little bit of room, and that's where your address goes. And I remember when I got my first postcard from him, I was like, what's all this trip? And I almost dropped it like it was hot. You know, I was like, holy cow, Alex Toth. And then running inside and sat down, took the phone off the hook and read it.
Well, talk about the book now. It's called Letters to John.
Yes.
John
Hitchcock is a retailer who runs Parts Unknown in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's a comic shop in the UNC Greensboro campus area. And it used to be with Acme Comics, which is another comic shop in the area. And in the 80s, they would put on really interesting shows. Like, they would bring down the EC guys. As growing up in North Carolina, I was just in this weird luck. I guess for all I knew, they were doing this in every state. You know, I was like, wow, this is cool. You know, like, it's like these books that I'm kind of interested in or whatever, and, you know, it's like I barely find out anything about. And then here's Al Williamson and George Evans or whoever coming to town.
Wow.
And go there, and he had Alex Toth out early on, and it took Alex to as luck would have it, like this one theater in town was showing a special release version of The Thin Man, which of course is right up Toth's alley. And
that's great.
Yeah, and him and John go watch it and everything. Toth's having time with his wife watching this on the big screen again. From that point, from a little bit before then, John and Alex were pen pals, and then Alex kind of made a bootlegger out of John because he had these cigarettes that he wanted that he couldn't get in California. So he would say, "Yeah, they'll send me some of those." So John would send him cartons of cigarettes or whatever, and then Alex, instead of throwing out, as he often would, his doodles and sketches, just started putting them in some of the envelopes and sending them to him.
Wow.
And then it just build up, and, you know, over decades, and, like, suddenly John had this fat stack of Alex Toth art. And one time, and this is after I had moved out to California, I'm in Oregon now, and I was visiting my relatives back home, and I went over to Greensboro to see John, and he said, "Hey, I've got the Toth art here," and went back in the back, and we're looking through it. I'm like, "Good grief, John, this is incredible." And he said, "Yeah," he said, "I'm thinking of putting it all together and, you know, doing a little Kinko's book or something to sell at shows." And at that point, I had just put out The Innerman. And, of course, when you buy barcodes, you have to buy, like, a block of 10, or at least you did at the time.
Okay.
And I said, "Well, I've got all these barcodes. If you want me to, I'll make a real book out of it, since I've already dealt with the printers and everything." And he slowly started. George Pratt was helping with it for a while, and George got busy with some other stuff, and then he found Billy Ingram, who does TVParty.com,
okay,
which is an interesting site, and Billy started laying the book out and just did a bang-up job and made John do end notes and everything. It was really nice. It's like the kind of thing that you always want to see done. And, then they came up to me and they said, "We've got the book together," and at this point, it was like more than a year and a half or 2 years or whatever from the point I'd said that. No, it was like 3 years, because I think I told him that in 2003.
Wow.
At this point, that's when Toth had been hospitalized, and they said things weren't looking good for him. So I would have normally actually spent, the whole summer kind of promoting the book before soliciting it. But I thought, I got to hurry up and try to get this out so we can get some to Alex, It's like, I don't know what kind of shape he's in.
Sure.
And luckily, even though, of course, he did die after the book had been solicited, he did get to see the galley of the book and go through and kind of, his son said, he sort of checked all off. And, it's fine. Good. Made some suggestions and sent it back. And so at least he knew it was coming, and he got to see it put together. But, that was kind of a huge disappointment for me, because I was even thinking, maybe I'll just fly down there with the first box or whatever and take it to him in the little retirement village thing he's living in.
Sure.
But, his family got copies of it, and they enjoyed it quite a bit. And once we get caught up on the, once I get myself paid off from it, and give Billy and John Counts some money for laying the book out, then we're going to send the money to the Toths, which we were originally going to send to Alex. And I got to check with them, because I thought John had said they might be setting up a scholarship. And, maybe we can just set up something where I just send everything to the scholarship or whatever from there.
Wow, that'd be great.
Yeah, because I never planned to make money on it. I just wanted to get it out because I thought it should have been a book.
He's a genius artist and certainly has his following, despite not having done any published work, like in a book or anything for decades.
Yeah.
But certainly so many books, examining his art and going over, various projects that he's done through the years have always popped up and always, are well received by that core group of fans that know the genius of this guy and how much he was able to accomplish with such little, so few pencil strokes,
Yeah, and it's one of those things you can't imitate, because it's the way someone thinks about things. It's just somebody who never rests on their laurels and goes, "Okay, here's how I do this." It seems like every time he got into a new project, he started from scratch again and thought about how he could do it again, which is, that's just fascinating. And, for years I've watched, great artists look at his stuff or see a story that they haven't seen of his before, And they all do the same thing. They all just kind of go pouring through the pages, nodding their heads, and then point their finger at it like, hey, look at that. It's always kind of fascinating to see cartoonists do this, because they're always like, you know, constantly impressed at how he came up with a solution to something, and often with things that they've struggled with themselves.
I think even it's so funny, you look back at in the I guess it was the 70s when he was even, not only did he come up with the designs for the Super Friends cartoon, but even, you know, more fun, and I think DC did trade it recently, the Super Friend comic books that he did. Because didn't he draw the comic books in the 70s?
No.
Oh, he didn't?
He did a little bit, but he just...
Was it just a little bit of art?
Did he do? Where's Jesse Hamm when I need him?
Exactly.
He was just in the studio and walked out. I could just grab him and say, Jesse, come here, you walking Toth.
Well, I remember one of those Treasury-sized books had, like, a feature that Toth did, explaining how he came up with character designs.
Yeah, and it's a long feature, too, and it still works. I mean, I worked in TV animation, and it's still good. I mean, there's a few things you do different now, and obviously technology, but essentially everything he's saying is right. And he goes into such detail. I even remember as a kid thinking, I can't understand this, because he was really explaining it very thoroughly. It's like a 6-page feature or something. But, I mean, what I was meaning is, yes, he did do Super Friends stories, or that weird thing where they pasted a Kurt Swan Superman head on the cover.
Yes,
but I mean,
I heard
he
that.
Just didn't do that many of them. He just did a little bit for that. But that's a great book to find, which is actually still pretty easy to find.
That giant Treasury-sized book?
Yeah, that giant Treasury.
Wow, because, I seem to remember a smaller, regular trade-size collection of Super Friends stories. And I, for some reason, thought there might be some Toth stuff in there. Maybe
I think
not.
It's just the same thing as the Giant, isn't it?
Oh, there you go. Maybe it is.
That's my thinking, but, you know, I am not the historian. I'm just some schmo who said, this ought to be a book.
Well,
and a big fan, obviously. But, Toth is great. And I feel a little bad I didn't write to him more than I did. But I was, frankly, scared because I knew a lot of horror stories of cartoonists, you know, Bruce Timm and people like that who corresponded with him, and then they caught him on a bad day and then had a falling out. And it wouldn't even be anything to do with them. It would be like somebody Toth voted for didn't win that day or something, and then you happen to call or whatever, wanting to talk comics, and then he's mad at you. Or, you know, blames the evil direction Batman's taken on you or something. It's like, and I was always kind of afraid of that. And Al Williamson always had this classic advice to people of don't go backstage. I mean, you know, it's like, even though actually I think it worked fine for Al Williamson because, like, he got to go meet Alex Raymond and had a really great day. He told me all about it years ago.
That's cool.
And but generally it kind of is good advice because, you know, what's more heartbreaking than you go meet one of your artistic heroes and, you know,
catch him on a bad day.
Well.
Yeah. No, I understand, and I, you know, and yet here I am talking to creators weekly, but I understand. I had that experience with Buster Crabb, speaking of Flash Gordon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, as a 12-year-old kid, and I mean, it was fine. I thinking back and stuff, I just needed to shut up and move on, and it was probably my
You walked up and said, hi, I'm John Suntree's word balloon, I'm 12 years old.
Yeah, yes. Pretty much. Yeah, I'm expecting.
Yeah, a little radio with.
I'm anticipating the internet someday, and I'd love to interview you. Yeah, you know, I saw him at a fan signing at a nostalgia shop and probably asked him one question too many. And I was like, can I ask you one more thing? He's like, no. I was like, okay. But I still treasure my photographs with him when I was a little kid, and it was still a great experience. But, yeah, it was like, oh. Yeah, took a while to get over
I've got a picture of me shaking Adam West's hand in the Batman outfit, too.
Very cool.
Yeah, I got my little autograph from one crime fighter to another. It's great. And of course, they did this little thing. It's like kind of an easy trick or whatever where while you're waiting in line. And of course, going back to the car shows, it was a car show.
Obviously. Of course it was.
Where else would Batman be? And they give you the picture of him in his civilian disguise in Batman and ask you to put your name on the back of it. And I say, I'm Jeff. And then, you know, 15 minutes later, by the time I'm up there to shake his hand, I've forgotten that I told somebody my name. And they hand him the thing, and he says, hello, Jeff. And I'm, like, shocked. He's like, Batman knows my name. Yeah. I'm just kidding. Oh, my God. Of course he does. He's Batman. Why wouldn't he know my name?
That's awesome.
He knows everything. But, man, there's one of the guys who probably just never really disappointed people too much because, you know, Adam West was very aware, and still is, you know.
Yes.
You know, kids like him or whatever, and gosh, he could go right into that shtick on the drop of a hat, you know.
Clayton Moore was the same way, and I got to meet him.
Oh, great.
Which, yeah, that was awesome at a Toys R Us way the hell back. And this was before they took away the mask from him and stuff, so he was still the Lone Ranger. And, yeah, just, hello, friend, and that great Clayton Moore voice. And it's like, wow. I mean, it was as I'm sure you felt the same way about meeting Adam West. Uh-huh. It's like there was a superhero come to life. I mean, there was the Lone Ranger. I met the Lone Ranger. It was
fantastic.
Isn't that
exciting? And you know, they're actually considering the fact that I've got a chance to make some kids' year here.
Yep.
And I'm going to do it. You know, it's like, you got to love that.
Yeah, and you're right. They appreciated the responsibility they had, and they fed off of it. I think they appreciated the admiration, too.
It's kind of weird. You know, it's like in the Hollywood Land just came out, and I haven't seen it yet. But obviously, it's the other direction that takes where, you know, George Reeves finds out he's typecast. People can't watch a movie without saying, hey, Superman.
Yep.
Can't take him seriously in any role.
I saw it. I thought the performances are great. I think it could have been edited and just been a little shorter.
Really?
But I think the performances are excellent, and I'd say to anyone who wants to see the film, definitely see it because it's worth it. And Affleck is amazing and I think has a good chance of getting an Oscar nomination out
really?
Of it, too. Yeah, I think so. Because,
I'm gonna see this now.
So he absolutely became George Reeves. It was really impressive how great he looked, especially as Clark Kent. My God, it was scary how much he looked like George Reeves. So,
well, I know they did a little bit of prosthetics on him, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, you even see that he's in a, maybe even as Clark Kent, but even, you know, when he puts on the suit, he's got, like, kind of padding and stuff to beef up the physique. But when he's wearing that gray flannel suit and he's got the big horn-rimmed glasses on and he's got that smile, it's like, that looks like George Reeves to me. I mean, it was scary how much he looked like him.
What I like, going back looking at those episodes, is the fact that Clark comes driving up in a little sports car. But he never even remotely acts mild-mannered. He just acts like George Reeves.
Yep. Yeah. Well, it was nice. It was, I mean, you know, it kind of made, yeah, I think Clark Kent was more of an investigative news reporter than he was the milquetoast that the comic books sometimes say about to
me. Try that. It was funny, too, because and whenever, like, Jimmy and Lois get in trouble, I mean, like, God, we need Mr. Kent. They don't. Superman isn't the first one they think of. First, they think of Mr. Kent. Of course, yeah. Go get that big burly guy in the suit. He'll take care of this.
It was great to see them both in the new Superman movie too.
Oh yeah.
And I think they both, you know, their cameos were some of the high points of the film. I think really. And I don't mean that as a backhanded slap. I think there are good things and bad things about the movie.
Yeah.
But luckily, the two of their cameos were a couple of the good things.
I really wanted that. You know, it was a little sleepy to me.
Yes.
I just really wanted that movie to be a little more involving than it was.
No, I agree with you. Did you see any, and now I'm blanking about any of the other hero movies. X3, of course. Yeah, I know
X3,
you saw that.
And see, now at this point, no one will take me seriously. Well, you're a Marvel shield, Parker. Of course you're going to like the X3 movie. But I'm sorry, it was fun.
No, I liked it too, man.
In it.
I didn't think visually
as strong as the Bryan Singer movies. Not by a long shot, but again, not a Marvel reference. But it was it had a lot of stuff going on. And it was pretty engaging. I thought, you know, it was a fun. I'm not putting it down there, you know, with It's a Wonderful Life or anything. But,
no.
But you know, I had a good time.
Yeah, I went in with low expectations because of everything I had heard and really didn't see it for the first few weeks and came out saying this is a much better movie than what I heard about. And I think it still kind of got a little clunky.
And Superman probably worked the other way, whereas
yes.
your expectations were probably raised way up. And then you go in and it's like, where's the story?
Yeah, it could have. Yeah, it should have been stronger. It really should have been a stronger story. I agree. I think it kind of fell apart, and it just kind of dragged at the end, unfortunately.
Yeah, and sadly, I just keep getting. What does this have to do with anything? And why do I get to talk about it? But because John Suntree's asked me. That's
right. No, this is the show.
But I'm sorry. All I keep thinking of is this other guy that Lois is involved with. Comes off as more heroic to me. He doesn't have any powers. And he's trying his best. And I'm supposed to sit there and be sympathizing with, screw Superman.
You're rooting for Richard White.
Cyclops over here. Because it is Cyclops.
That's
I can't
right.
remember that actor's name.
James Marsden.
James Marsden,
yeah.
James Marsden's like, hey, you know, he's put in the unenviable position. It's like you're the guy who's the foil of Superman. And I think the idea with that was supposed to be to make you relate to Superman more, but it worked exactly the opposite to me.
No, I didn't understand a lot of story choices that Singer made in that film. And also, I just think Kate Bosworth is, I think she's gorgeous.
She's very pretty.
But she's no Lois Lane to me.
That's always been the eternal thing. And even in comics, everybody's had a hard time getting the character of Lois down.
I don't know. I thought Noel Neal and Margot Kidder, I thought, did decent jobs with her. And I although Phyllis Coates, way too bitchy.
Oh, yeah.
Man, she just hated Clark Kent. It's like, you know, Lois, go to hell.
Yeah.
I know it's 1955 and we can't say it, but go to hell.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that seems to be the way everybody swings with her. It's just like, come on now, make Lois. There's got to be some reason Superman's just so enwrapped with her.
Well, and also, I just didn't see Tough Reporter from Kate Bosworth.
Right.
It just, I don't know what, I didn't know what she was playing. I honestly don't. But
yeah, again, it's one of those things where, and then they did give her the little bit where I'm more focused on this this other thing that leads to the scoop.
Yeah.
That's always one of those things where, like, in, you know, you get a Justice League sort of thing and Batman solves the crime by being the only one who's, you know, not that dense.
I got you. No, I know what you mean.
It's like, because he realized something very basic that anybody would have thought of.
Well, and I'll give it up to DC for, or I should say Warner Brothers for getting the Batman film right, because I thought Batman Begins was excellent.
And I
also think there was enough right about Superman that they can fix it, and the next film will be better.
Yes.
And I really believe that.
Yes, they just need a much stronger story and. Christopher Nolan to do it.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
He did a great job with Batman. Get him over there.
There you go. How do you think Daniel Craig's going to do his Bond? We're months away.
Well, you know, I like a lot of people. I really wanted that to be...
Clive Owen?
Clive Owen. I mean, God, if anybody was born to play James Bond, it was clearly him.
I agree with that. But I like Daniel Craig. I got to say, I thought, especially after Munich, I really thought Munich really... And I love Layer Cake.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Layer Cake?
I haven't, but enough people I trust recommend it highly.
Yeah, and I would say based on those two films that I think it always, as you said with Moonraker, it always depends on the script with the Bond films.
Yeah, like to me, one of the best Bond movies is From Russia with Love.
You bet.
You know, it's like when you get down to him and Captain Quint.
Robert Shaw.
Robert Shaw fighting in the train. One of
yes.
the most realistic fights in a movie I've ever seen.
No question.
And
at the beginning
of the movie, he's trying to kill somebody. He's doing a Bond type of job, which
yes.
is, you know, it's like, ooh, it's not pretty, but that's what he's supposed to be doing.
No, and a guy physically imposing that can stand up to Bond without it being a freak like Oddjob was or Jaws, where it really is just another
after Goldfinger, it all just becomes cartoons most of the time, and there's still bits I like, you know, I enjoyed Live and Let Die and things
sure.
like that.
To me, Live and Let Die, he looks like that's like his Nick Fury stage. He's almost got an action suit like a S.H.I.E.L.D. suit, you know, to me.
Yeah, it is. He just needs a Hela carrier.
And an eye patch.
I wish we could see a scaled-down Bond where it really is just less about gadgets and wacky characters with mirror eyes or whatever and just give you a good espionage thriller.
I'm with you.
Because that's what the books are.
No, you're right about that. And I know you're busy with Marvel stuff as we wrap up. I always have to ask about Inner Man and what prospects. Is it on the shelf until you have more time to get back to it?
Yeah, I've got to meet my Marvel deadlines because they pay me better than I pay myself.
I respect that.
And and I got these kids and stuff. But I think I'll finally get around to Inner Man Zero just because, like, now at least I can afford to spend time drawing my own stuff. You know, it's like I've got plenty of writing work, so I don't have to, you know, go draw for somebody else, which takes me longer than it does to write.
Sure.
So, yeah, again, relearn how to draw, and then then I can draw these Inner Man stories. And Tom Coker, who did that man called Hurricane thing, has drawn half of one of the stories in Inner Man Zero. So I'll probably whine at him and send him cakes and stuff. And, try to get the rest of it out of him. But then again, I let Marvel sneak in on that one too, because then I lured Tom into the cover, you know, and Mark Panicia asked him, and I was like, cool, please, yes, please do these covers. And so, yeah, it's tough. And, you know, people will often get mad at you, like, hey, I like this book, when are you going to get to this? And it's like, well, you do like me not being in the streets too, right?
Yeah.
I hope, you know, it's like, I'll get to it. Actually, some progress has been made on the New Line Cinemas front with the Interman movie.
Cool.
They've assigned these British guys, the Griffith brothers, to do another draft of the screenplay. And everybody seems very impressed with them. And they sound pretty impressive what I've heard. So, you know, if that gets through and I could actually go into development, that would certainly help me set aside some time to get back on Interman. Now I'm just wondering if my style is going to change rapidly, because a lot of things I want to draw now are a little different than what I wanted to draw a couple of years ago.
Okay.
It's just the way I like to, I don't know, it's just keep it interesting for me. Up to a certain point, I've got to keep that looking kind of the same, or it's just going to be confusing if I suddenly go off in a totally different style.
Well, whenever it does happen, we look forward to it.
Oh, of course. I'll go, John, please interview me. I want to talk about it. Please.
Fair not. Absolutely. And no, man, like I said, I'm really digging Agents of Atlas. I look forward to First Class.
Yeah, thanks for helping talk about it and everything.
My pleasure, man. And it's a great series. And if you're not reading it, you certainly should be, because it's great spy adventures with a bunch of Marvel characters that fell by the wayside. And thankfully, Jeff has picked them up and dusted them off and told us why they're good.
That to me is endlessly fascinating, that, you know, a character can lay dormant and then come back, and it's weird because they do have a life of their own. You know, you sit there and think, well, I'm doing this, but in a way you're not. You know, it's like in a way, in some, like maybe some kind of Alan Moore idea space sort of theory, they do exist in some level all by themselves.
The characters are writing themselves.
Yeah, it's Gorilla Man. Clearly, I don't even think I have any control over him. I think he's just going to... He's now easily the most popular gorilla in the Marvel Universe.
That's awesome. Well, good luck with First Family.
Cool.
And for First Class, I should say.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, I keep it up, and we'll be looking at it.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
That's writer Jeff Parker. Make sure you check out Agents of Atlas, which will be out this week, number 3. Also, X-Men First Class, and lots of other great projects from Jeff. And if you reach back, ask your comic store to pick up The Inner Man, the great graphic novel that Jeff wrote a couple years back. And make sure you check out Dear John as well, the Alex Toth tribute book, featuring incredible art and insight from the master artist. That'll do it for this edition of WordBalloon.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to WordBalloon. Lots more episodes on the way. WordBalloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.